Welcome to New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. Each week I present people who are at the leading edge of our evolutionary change. And tonight I have a very interesting guest, someone who's really devoted her life to transformation. I'll be talking to Veronica Monet. She's a certified sexologist and involved with lots of organizations that are bringing forth new types of understanding of sexuality and how we are really sexually, spiritually evolving beings. I mean, we're sexual and spiritual at the same time. Veronica, are you here?
I'm here, Alan. Great to be here, too. Thank you.
I wanted to say you are the founding member of the Association of Sexual Energy Professionals and a trained volunteer for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. So, and do you want to give you a little background about your, I wouldn't say your sexual history, but how you became an authority in the area of sexuality?
Well, one of the things that has always been a little bit amusing to me is how many so-called sexperts don't have a lot of sex. They just read about it and study it. So I'm an interesting combination. I've got 60 hours of training as a certified sex educator through the San Francisco Sex Information. 60 hours of training is actually about five times as much as most medical doctors get, which is kind of a sad commentary on our medical professions.
Right.
But the really interesting thing is really the 14 years of hands-on experience as a sex professional. So I worked as an escort, a courtesan, and I also have produced and appeared in amateur porn. I don't just talk about it from, you know, an armchair. I've been there, done that, and I talk about it from experience.
And a big part of your work now is about getting rid of the shame that people have around sex. I mean, you would think here we are, the year 2000, and people are still hung up about their bodies.
Well, you know, I actually have a new lecture called Building a Bridge from Sexual Shame to Peace.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, one of the, I've just started looking at all the ways in which we are destroying this planet because of our sexual taboos. So, I mean, we can't have honest conversations about AIDS. We can't have honest conversations about overpopulation. We can't talk about non-procreative ways to enjoy orgasms and sexual contact so that we could end up, you know, saving this planet. So that's really a scary thing. And then, you know, add to that the fact that we've got still a lot of hate crimes that are generated around sexuality, whether it's somebody who's transgender, gay, lesbian, or sex workers. Sex workers are also, being murdered and raped because of hate crimes, and a lot of times the law doesn't even recognize that.
Well, I do want to get into the whole idea of the disconnection from our body and the disconnection from the earth itself, which is an extension of our body. But I just like to know a little bit more about you. Did you always have this upfront feeling about sex? I mean, was it ever a taboo or something that you had to get over?
Oh, I was raised in a very conservative, right-wing Christian home. I read the Bible from cover to cover by the time I was 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of hang-ups. I had a lot of guilt and shame, definitely. But I also found that it was really hard for me to fit into that box, you know. So it was more like my behavior didn't match what I was told I should do.
Uh-huh.
So there was you know, there was kind of like this, I'm doing something wrong. I wonder why I do this, why I can't be a good girl, what's wrong with me? Those kind of feelings.
So what got you through that? I mean, how did you come out the other side with an enlightened sexual attitude?
You know, I got a really unique answer to that question. I was homeschooled. And because I was homeschooled, I was never really part of a peer group.
Yeah.
And I actually kind of entered the American culture feeling like an alien, even though I'd been born in this country, raised in this country, very strongly identified with my country of origin, and yet not really part of the culture. So I was actually able to kind of look at it from more of a scientific, analytical standpoint, like going, oh, that's interesting that people have these beliefs, but they don't really seem to impinge upon any facts.
What about that Christian background, though? Didn't that impinge upon your feelings?
Except for the fact that I had a crisis of faith early on.
That's always good.
So the founder of our church, my mother belonged to a little Christian cult, the founder of the church did some things that really flew in the face of beliefs that he claimed to espouse, and it really gave me the freedom to reject that religion and go find my own spiritual center.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I wasn't real strongly identified with my family of origin. I was always a little different, more independent, very independent thinker. So by the time I got to college, I took classes in human sexuality and started learning things like masturbation is good for you. And I go, really? Wow. So I really took to it. You know, I took to the whole idea of being free and liberated.
And was there any shame around being a sex professional, though?
The first day. The first day I went home and took a long shower and thought, I must be crazy. I've got a college diploma. Why am I doing this?
You mean first time you got paid to have sex with someone, you thought that. And then what happened for you?
Again, I just went back to the, well, but that's not logical. That's silly. You know, people get paid to be therapists. You know, you can listen to somebody's problems and get paid. That's a very personal thing. I mean, you know, used to be people were very ashamed to go see a therapist and wouldn't dream of doing that because they thought that that was really taboo. And eventually people started opening up to the idea that we could get a lot out of paying a professional to help us with our deep, dark, personal dramas. And I really looked at the sex industry in that way. I was like, this is a service that can be very helpful to people. And this is one of the reasons that I believe no matter where we have been culturally over the last 6,000 years of human history, prostitution has always existed. And prostitution exists with the bonobos, which are an ape that's really closely related to us.
Uh-huh.
And they have lots of promiscuity and lots of sex available to everybody, and they still engage in prostitution. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, that is amazing. No, I heard they're a very loving group of primates as well.
They absolutely are. But, you know, a lot of people think, well, if we were having a lot of free sex, then nobody would ever charge for it or pay for it. And nature does not bear that out to be true. So prostitution is not even the oldest profession. Prostitution is one of the earliest elements of the evolutionary development of sexuality that predates humans.
Well, I think calling it prostitution, though, then we need to call it something else because that has gotten to be such a bad word.
Oh, see, Ellen, I am all about reclaiming those words.
Okay.
I'm not going to let them have that word. They can think it's bad if they want to, but that's part of the challenge, you know, because it's kind of like, you know, when you start drifting things up with, okay, well, let's not call it sex, let's call it lovemaking. And then somehow or another that's going to make it a more approachable topic, but you never really get down to the core shame when you do that.
But isn't the thing about prostitution, the disconnection that people have to intimacy, isn't that the big complaint people have about that.
I think it's kind of ironic. I think it's really interesting because, you know, you think about during the 50s, there was this whole thing about wives should just kind of suffer through the sex act to fulfill their wifely duties.
Right.
And nobody ever thought, well, we better, you know, so marriage is bad because these women are not having orgasms. So I think that's interesting, you know, because then we turn around and say, well, prostitution is bad because people are not having a personal connection. And yet I go into the colleges and I show them these slideshows
uh-huh.
of actual sacred prostitution, and it blows them away because there's some incredibly personal, spiritual stuff going on under the label prostitution.
Well, describe sacred prostitution. Tell us what that means.
I think the easiest way to distinguish this would be to say that, let's go back to that example around marriage. You've got two people that are in love with each other, and they're married, so they're going to have one type of sex. And then you have maybe a husband and wife who do not connect with each other emotionally, and they're going to have a different kind of sex. And the same thing happens in the sex industry. You have people who are coming together with the intention of creating something that's sacred or special or deep or important or intense or personal. And then you have people who are trying desperately to avoid all emotional connections.
Mm-hmm.
So that really, people's intention around sex varies greatly, but it's not really dependent on whether or not cash has changed hands or not.
That's true.
And
what does it depend on, the sexual experience you feel?
Yeah, it does. I mean, like, you know, I always, when I talk to the students, I go, look, if you were examining marriage just from the standpoint of the domestic violence survivor, you would think we need to abolish it now. You know? Because people are in hospitals. Right now, tonight, there are people in the hospitals because they got married.
What do you mean?
At the same time, well, domestic violence. It usually
happens because they got married, though. It's not really the marriage. It's the relationship.
Oh, yeah. No. It really can be. Drug care is a topic I'm well acquainted with. Sometimes people can live together for years,
uh-huh.
and as soon as they say, I do, some of their old patterns kick in, patterns that are passed down from generation to generation.
Wow.
And so in the act of actually saying, I do, there's this level of possessiveness and expectation that did not exist in the relationship before they got married.
Mm. So do you believe in monogamy as well, or do you think that's part of the problem?
I believe in choice.
Uh-huh.
I believe in choice. I think polyamory, promiscuity, being single, being celibate, abstaining, masturbating, being married, all of that, it's all great as long as people are coming from a place from choice. And one of the things that I teach in my workshops is you really can't come from a place of choice unless you've learned how to say no. This is
no
one of the
to
things
other people, no to...
Yeah. I actually sometimes, for some people, will recommend abstinence for at least a limited period of time so that they can become acquainted with some of their barriers to being able to assert their boundaries. You know, this is one of the things that went wrong in the 60s and 70s with the whole free love thing. We didn't have any boundaries, or, you know, no permission to say no.
And then what happened as a result of that, you feel?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was born in 1960, so I kind of missed that. But I got the tail end of the 70s, just before AIDS came out.
Uh-huh.
But historically, what I've studied about the free love movement, it sounds like there was a kind of a splitting off with women. This is actually, you know, some of the feminism came out of that because there was a lot of anger. And resentment about the fact that you were considered a square if you weren't having sex.
I see.
And a lot of women didn't even get to deal with, you know, their incest and rape issues, which is huge for a lot of women. There's a lot of women who have at least experience something like a date rape, even if they don't consider themselves an actual rape survivor. And when I work with women, a lot of times we have to crawl through this whole backlog of abuse issues before we ever get to celebrate the pleasure with sex. It's sad, but it's true.
That's what your work is really about, in a way, is getting through the backed up energy around sex so we can experience more pleasure, because that's what we're here to do. We're here to experience pleasure as part of our human existence.
Not only that, but, you know, just like to go back to my favorite animals, the bonobos, where we can take two animals that are our closest living genetic relatives, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, and between the three of us, humans, chimpanzees, and bonobos, we share so much DNA, we could all be the same animal. And yet, the chimpanzees and the humans suffer from rape, murder, and war. And then you go and study the bonobos, and they don't have any of that. Which isn't to say the bonobos are these absolutely non-violent. They have arguments and fights, and they've been known to, like, chew somebody's toe or finger off. But that is a far cry from ripping somebody's arms and legs off and drinking their blood.
Is that what the chimpanzees do?
You betcha. Chimpanzees will commit murder in order to obtain political power, and Jane Goodall documented a 4-year war with the chimpanzees.
Wow. So tell me,
they're much like humans.
But tell me about the bonobos, and tell me about how we could live as a society with that same attitude. I mean, same openness. What do they have that we need as a human civilization in order to?
You know, first and foremost, they have something that's really hard for us to wrap our minds around, because for the last, since recorded history, we really have been a male-dominated people on this planet. Mm-hmm. And there's a few cultures. There's, I think, the Mushua up in China and just a couple around the planet where this is not the case. They have more metrifocal societies, and they do tend to be less violent, if not completely peaceful. Mm-hmm. But mostly we have been a warring people who were male-dominated and fixated always. If you look at all of the monotheistic religions, the number one principle is control the sexuality of a female.
Mm.
So this becomes a huge, important thing with patriarchy, that you've got to control when the women have sex, who they have sex with, why they have sex. And because of this expenditure of energy around that, it tends to create a scarcity of sex. And this creates frustration and pent-up aggressions. And so then you've got competition for sex, and violence is born out of that. The bonobos solve their problems through sex. When they're feeling violent or competitive, two opposing tribes meet in a field and they're sugar cane. What do? They yell and scream at each other, and then they decide to have an orgy and share the food.
Oh.
Whereas the chimpanzees might declare a 4-year war and murder each other.
But going back to what you said about sexual freedom, it seems like in the West, women now have that freedom, and we still have a lot of sexual hangups. Women can say no. They are free to express their sexuality, and it's very open.
It's a good commentary, but it doesn't hold water, unfortunately, because what we still have is this whore-Madonna split. We have got women that are considered to be bad girls, and then we have women that are considered to be good girls, and we have a real split around what we expect out of mothers. So if you are raising children, we really hold you to a totally different standard. Even though, you know, the pop star Madonna, when she got pregnant and had her first kid, she completely changed her wardrobe and her makeup and her hair, and it was like, you know, she was trying to kind of regrow her cherry. And there's a lot of that. Women get very, very conflicted around their whole role as wives and mothers, where they are attempting to disavow any of their sexual promiscuity from before. And it's very painful if you look at what's happening in the high school, right when puberty hits, right at age 12 and 13, the girls start sorting each other out as sluts and good girls.
What do you suggest, though? I mean, if you could run the world, what do you suggest?
I would absolutely positively say that women need to be accepted as fully sexual creatures, kind of like we expected. Our men, have you noticed, let's go back to Bill Clinton. Remember him and Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah.
Monica Lewinsky had to leave the United States and go to the United Kingdom to get a job.
Uh-huh.
Bill Clinton's popularity rating went up in the United States.
Right.
So we still have this horrific double standard, regardless of what we want to say about all women have choice. We're very punishing. If you step out of certain bounds, you become unemployable or we may take your children away. Certainly as a sex worker, I know all about getting arrested, evicted. It's pretty harsh.
So it seems like if we could allow children at the age, as puberty, to have sex, to just say, okay, this is your sexual energy, just go for it and, you know, make it safe and all that, but give children developing the freedom to do that, which they probably did in ancient times, it would seem like we'd have a much more adjusted society and not be so uptight about it.
One of the things that you have to be very careful about making exact extrapolations from, like the bonobos. The bonobos have intergenerational sex, for instance. And as an incest survivor, I would definitely not endorse that. I have no idea what that would look like in a culture that wasn't patriarchal. But as long as we have a system where adults have power over their children, then that would not work because there is coercion. There's fear. Our entire system is predicated upon that kind of a structure, so that's why we have sexual harassment on the job, because an employer really has a lot of power over the people who work for them.
So you're saying sex has a lot more to do with control and power in our culture than pleasure, really. It's come down to that.
Oh, my God. I have to tell you something, Alan. Working with clients for those 14 years, I became convinced that most men do not even enjoy sex. And I'm sure there's a lot of men out there listening right now who would argue that point, but it's just the emphasis is so much on membership and power and position and ego, and I don't mean ego in a macho way. What I really mean is that sex makes us feel like we know who we are, depending on how we have sex, who we have sex with. We decide what station in life we have achieved. And the reason that I say that so many men don't actually enjoy sex is because a man would pay hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars for a moment of pleasure, supposedly, and yet might forego it, might say, no, I want to be the special guy who comes to see you and doesn't have sex with you. Okay, so that's about ego. I want to be the special client. So I encountered a lot of that, lot of that. And then the other thing, of course, just not being in your body. So don't touch my nipples and don't touch my rectum because that'll make me gay. And then by the time I get to my orgasm, probably not as eventful as a sneeze because I'm holding so much of this fear that I'm going to be like a woman or a gay guy or an animal or whatever. So I've got to be civilized and I've got to be controlled and I've got to hold it all in.
And you say most men probably are like that. They've disconnected from feeling their body, from feeling sensation.
So my job was to transform that into total pleasure, and it took a lot of convincing and a lot of coaxing and a lot of talent.
Well,
but, you know, the first thing you have to do is reassure this person that they're not gay. That was a huge thing with heterosexual men. Well, if I experience pleasure, that means I'm gay.
If they experience any kind of pleasure, that's what that means they're gay?
If it's anything besides the penis.
Oh. And so you got them to experience their whole body more.
Yes. Exactly. Well, like what? Your earlobes, your neck, your nipples, the insides of your thighs, your scrotum. I mean, there's so many erogenous zones on a man, but trying to make a man comfortable enough so he can experience those, it really depended a lot on demographics, you know, like people's educational and career background as well as their age, you know, what generation they came from. But I saw an awful lot of that. It made me sad because men have every bit as much sexual response and every bit as many erogenous zones as a woman does.
That's interesting. I always thought women had more myself. But
everybody thinks that, but it's a total myth. It's a total myth. I've had sex with men and women, and I'm here to tell you it's the same animal. It's just a little different configuration.
So, do you enjoy your work? I mean, immensely, as pleasurable.
Well, you know, I stopped escorting at the beginning of 2004.
Why is that?
And sometimes I miss it. Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and the money was great. But
why did you
I really
stop?
Because I wanted to write a book before I turned 45.
And I knew
that as long as I was escorting, I wouldn't have the economic incentive, and I wouldn't find the time.
But did you enjoy your work? Did you get a lot of pleasure from having sex with people you didn't know?
I did not engage in it for the sexual pleasure. I engaged in it for the spiritual and emotional pleasure.
Well, tell me about the spiritual pleasure. What does that mean exactly?
Let's say somebody comes to see you and they're shut down emotionally and you don't know exactly why they're there to see you, and you might even find them a little bit irritating at times. But you go ahead and you spend time with this person because you really are committed to being a healer.
Mm.
And 6 months down the road, they tell you that they're dying. One of their last wishes is that they'd like to have an orgasm before they die because they haven't been able to have one for a year.
Uh-huh.
And if you can be a part of that process, that's pretty meaningful.
And you were, it sounds like. That happened.
Yeah. I had clients who were differently able. They might have been in accidents where they were missing parts of their bodies, or they could be paralyzed. You know, quadriplegic.
And you would make them feel their body again. You'd give them back what it is to be human, which is sensation.
But it's more than that, and that's sensation's great. Our bodies are wonderful, but I really believe that if you know, for me, sacred prostitution is all about using the body and sex to gain access to the divine. It's about transcending through.
And how do we do that? I mean, how do we do that? I mean, there's exercises to do that within the tantric school, but I think you're talking about more connection, huh?
I am, and a lot of it's in tension. Now, I use PC muscle exercises, and I use conscious breathing, and I use meditation, and I use prayer, and I all kinds of things, affirmations, visualizing. There's amazing things that you can do with sex, and to where it takes on some magical properties. And if you think sex is not just about pleasure, but as the focus place where we create. This is where we create. Everything is created in a sexual way in this universe. Even galaxies are created in a sexual way because they're created by the merging of other galaxies. If you look at the blueprint for this universe, everything that happens happens in a sexual way. Spring is on the way. And everybody's we're going to be so excited about spring. Spring's a beautiful time when the babies are being born, flowers are blooming, the birds are singing their songs. But if you really stop for a minute and analyze what is so beautiful and magical about spring, it's sex. Because those flowers are sexual organs, and the birds are singing songs because they're looking for mates and trying to chart off their territory. So all of that is about sex. And when we try to separate ourselves from sex, or we try to put sex over in a corner and just think about it as nothing more than sensation or fun or pleasure, which are all wonderful aspects of sex, but it doesn't capture its core. Sex is the core of each and every one of us. That kundalini energy lives at the base of your spine, and it drives the creative impulse. Every time you build a bridge or a building, or you write a book, or you design a dress, or you paint a room, you are accessing your sexual energy.
Or even seeing a performance or a movie, it's the receiver and the giver, I think you're saying, is the sexual act.
It is. There's this whole sexual, sensual aspect to our being that we've been asked to abandon or cut ourselves off from, it so that we don't get to live in our bodies and be fully joyous. And, I mean, there's amazing things that can happen as far as opening that door. And this is what the ancient sacred prostitutes knew. They knew that they were a door to the divine. And that the whole culture was around sex is sacred. And one of the things that I talk about is that I don't consider that there's certain types of sex that is sacred, just like I don't think there's certain types of life that is sacred. I think all life is sacred, and I think all sex is sacred. And, go ahead.
No, from what I've read about calling sex sacred, what it seems to refer to is when you can move the energy from the genitals and move it to open up areas of consciousness, that's, you're taking it from the realm of pleasure, and it's still sacred as pleasure, but you're moving it for expansion of mind and vision. And when I've been able to do that, I find a real clarity to my thoughts and a kind of energy actually coming out of my eyes. I just feel myself pulsating. So, I mean, there's no right and wrong way, but I do feel there are some exercises that are more beneficial that I feel more energized. So
I certainly feel more drawn to certain things too. I mean, I used to really love mainstream porn because I loved the close-ups of genitals, and I found that really erotic. And I really do believe that that can be a form of worship as well. But my own spiritual path has taken me far, far away from that. I don't even think about sex when I am having orgasms now. I think about nature and the universe and the stars, which is really way out there. But
no, tell me about your spiritual path. And did your sex work get in the way of having relationships? Is also a question that
I was so lucky in that respect. I've had a lot of girlfriends and guy friends, but especially my girlfriends who worked in the sex industry, who found it very, very difficult to maintain relationships.
Uh-huh.
But I was really blessed. I was married almost the entire time.
Uh-huh.
And my husband was very supportive, and he did a few talk shows with me even, but mostly he kind of was behind the scenes, and he had his own job. We met back when I was fresh out of college in the telecommunications industry, and we were very kind of a real standard pedestrian suburban family. I mean, we had this open marriage, but we never really went out with anybody except that I was working, and dating my work. We'd come home from work and you know, watch something on the, watch a blockbuster movie, walk our dog around the block, have dinner. I mean, it was just really a very normal life.
Well, can't sex also lead to love? I mean, let's say you have really great sex with someone and you want to keep seeing them. I mean, can't that get in the way of a relationship that you're having?
Well, you know, I have, again, this is unique to my situation. I would say absolutely that could happen.
Yeah.
Did it happen for me? No, it did not happen for me. The reason that it didn't happen for me was because I just have this connection with, you know, I'm divorced now, but my ex-husband, I still consider him my soulmate. He's just like somebody I have a special connection with that I'm probably never going to duplicate with anybody else.
Right.
And I certainly haven't yet, and it's been 25 years.
Okay.
Well, it was just kind of, I met lots of wonderful people, good-looking people, wealthy people, intelligent people, accomplished people, and I loved them up to a point. I loved them as people, but I wasn't in love with them, and it was never any kind of a competition for what I felt for my husband.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. So then tell me about your spiritual development then. How did that emerge? Did it emerge from the work you were doing, or is that a separate kind of branch of your life?
It started off separate. It started off first. I was, I'm a recovered alcoholic, so I actually was going through recovery, 12-step recovery and therapy.
Uh-huh.
And so that's really where it started for me. And about 4 years into that is when I went into the sex industry. And I was really absolutely shocked to find that the sex industry became an integral part of my spiritual journey. So,
yeah,
I mean,
describe
really,
that. I think that's really important, that area.
I took a workshop from a woman named Cozy Fabian about ancient sacred prostitution, and it blew my mind. I learned about all of these goddesses, and I learned that, you know, prostitutes were close to the divine, and they were a doorway between two worlds, and I learned that the original virgins were actually the prostitutes who were working in the temple, and all it meant was that you were your own woman, and you weren't owned by a man. So, reframing all of these words and concepts was huge for me, and the real big one for me was changing my relationship to my body. As a woman, I had always looked at my body as something that could be degraded and used up and worn out.
Huh.
And they talk about women that way. She's used up, she's dried up, she's, you know, women are like a bottle of wine. You use them until they're all used up, and then you throw them away and go on to the next one.
Uh-huh.
Sloppy seconds. I mean, we've got just a whole number of degrading, abusive ways that we refer to women who have multiple sexual partners.
Uh-huh.
So when you're walking around thinking this way about your body, right up to the point where I can tell you I felt embarrassed by the fact that I had to squat to pee, you know?
Mm.
Where it's like men were so proud that they had penises and they stood up. And I think about the comedians, you know, there for a while. It was real popular to go on the Comedy Channel. These comedians would be pantomiming having doggy-style sex with a girl.
Right.
They'd be pretending that they were slapping her ass and, you know, really giving it to her. And I never saw a woman get up on the stage and go through the motions of showing herself spreading her legs for sex.
Uh-huh.
So this inherent shame around our physicality as women was huge. And when I took this workshop, this woman, Cozy Fabian, taught us that our vaginas were these powerful muscles, not orifices, a muscle. Any muscle in your body, if you use it repeatedly, becomes stronger.
Right.
So when I started thinking
about... There are also doorways to other dimensions. I mean, this is where the birth takes, or the beings, you know, a being, a newborn coming from another dimension, I feel, into this world passes through that doorway.
Yes, and that's when you study the history and you realize that there was this huge religious war, and the people who worshipped women's genitals and the sex act lost.
Oh.
And
when
you
did
realize,
that I don't remember hearing about that. When did that happen?
You know what? You can find, if you know what to look for, you can find it in the Old Testament Bible.
Uh-huh.
Because when the Israelites are invading the land of the Canaanites and the Philistines, they talk about the women having way too much power. And they also talk about pulling trees down from the high places. Well, the tree in a high place is an ancient pagan worship. That's a symbol for pagan worship, which pagan worship is all about worshiping the goddesses. And they had a lot of sexual rites. So, I mean, like, even when the Israelites, they get tired of waiting for Moses to come down from Mount, well, I think Mount Ararat, I'm not sure, I can't remember.
Mount
no,
Sinai.
Mount Ararat.
Sinai.
Sinai, thank you. Ararat's the one Noah's Ark was...
Exactly, that's in Turkey. Sinai's in the Sinai
Desert. Yeah, they're waiting for Moses to come back with the Ten Commandments, and they get tired, and so they make a golden calf, and they start having a bunch of orgies.
Uh-huh.
And that is all coming out of a different religion than the one that was being born through monotheism.
Right.
Monotheism was, I'm a jealous god, and you can't have any other gods. And then it was all about, you know, sex is taboo.
And it became a patriarchal, male-dominated culture from there on out.
Yes, and through genocide. Through genocide, and if you read the Old Testament Bible, it actually goes into great detail about how to kill these people and who you should kill. And you're instructed that you can, quote-unquote, marry the virgin women that you take captive, you can, quote-unquote, marry them, which is just a euphemism for rape.
Uh-huh.
But anybody who is has been pregnant or is pregnant should be killed because you don't want to propagate the enemy's children.
Well, not just the Judeo-Christian origins of our culture, but the Greek origins, where we're really connected to the Greek. You know, the Iliad starts with this argument between Achilles and Agamemnon over the woman that they both want, you know, and they both want to own this woman, and that's the beginning of Western literature, that poem by Homer.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But if you go back to the story of Gilgamesh, which is one of the earliest written, recorded stories, there you have a story about a man who's living like an animal and is civilized by a prostitute.
Ah.
One of the very first stories ever told.
Well, do you also know the white tigress tradition where and the green jade dragon? Do you know that tradition in China?
I know.
Oh, that's an amazing... there's a book out by a guy in Santa Fe. It's about this whole Chinese tradition of the white tigress, where she would have sex with these young boys in order to regenerate her body. You know, and they'd be in partnership with the jade dragon, and they'd kind of develop this energy together, but then he'd allow her... and she'd allow him to have sex with these other partners, but it would be all a part of their own spiritual development. As a book called The Sexual Teachings of the Jade Dragon by Hsilai, H-S-I-L-A-I. And it's a great...
Do you see any connections with that tradition and what seems to be a very... it just seems to me like this is a new thing where we've got a lot of women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who are taking younger lovers.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed that culturally, but it's become rather popular.
And do you think that's a good thing? It feels like a good thing.
You know, I think it's fabulous because I think that we're starting to actually have some of the wonderful things that women have known about older men all along, which is that, you know, sometimes they can be a lot more interesting to spend time with than somebody who's young and doesn't really have a clue. And I think to have female wisdom acknowledged in that way, and power, female power and wisdom, I think that's fabulous.
Well, it seems like women, not until they get in their 40s or 50s, and maybe it's our culture, do they really drop into their bodies. I mean, you see a lot of the younger women, and it, I think it is our conditioning, that don't aren't connected. They're not connected to their womb chakras. They're not connected to their sensuality. And older women seem to be more connected, you know?
Yeah, well, you finally drop the whole, you know, am I a good girl or a bad girl thing, and let's just go, I just want to enjoy life, you know, while I'm here.
Tell me then about your spirit. So you were in the AA program, and you, you know.
Well, I always just say 12-step because I don't.
12-step. It's all that. But
yeah,
how did that then open up to more of a spiritual understanding? I mean, I know it's a spiritual, but for you, where you started to have these other types of experiences that were, in a way, beyond the body. You know what I mean?
When I was first, you know, I was 4 years in a 12-step program, and then I started going into prostitution, I lost a lot of friends. It was a difficult thing for people to wrap their minds around.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, I had a hard time understanding what is wrong with me. But then I found this other woman. She was also in 12-step. And I met other women who were in 12-step. Then I started getting clients who were in 12-step, and I started realizing that there was actually quite a few people who were on a spiritual path and were either, you know, providers or clients in the sex industry. And that was kind of eye-opening in itself, kind of like a little dirty secret there, you know. But that's the dirty secret that's everywhere. That's the dirty secret that organized religion has and politicians have and just, you know, about every profession of life, walk of life you want to talk about.
But tell me about more of the spiritual experiences that you had as you started to go deeper into. Once I made
peace with my anatomy, I found that I wasn't so angry at men.
Uh-huh.
And then I was able to start approaching them as a representative of the goddess and with the attitude that sex is a healing, wonderful thing, and I wanted to be honored for imparting this gift with money, which was an ancient tradition of the sacred prostitutes, and I wanted to impart this very sacred gift.
You know, I think money actually started with the prostitute. The farmer would give a bushel to the sacred feminine and to ensure the fertilization of the crops. And I think
I believe that too.
The very foundation of money itself began there. So, and then you started to really embody.
As I started to actually experience what I call transpersonal love for my clients, which is absolutely positively a very deep, meaningful connection, but it's not one that's attached. This is one of the things that's sometimes a little difficult to teach in our culture because people think that this need to control and own is what they call love. And
right.
I just call that selfishness.
Well, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Yeah. But love can take a lot of different forms, but it's usually about the well-being of the beloved, not, you know, what you can own or possess and how you can feel important by owning and possessing them. So transpersonal love takes on incredibly detached proportions. It would be something like you would expect hopefully a very loving, caring therapist to have, but certainly somebody who is a religious person, you know, a minister or something, you would hope that they might have this transpersonal love so that they would care about the people that they work with, but they don't come home with them.
Mm.
Right? So you have professional boundaries, if you will.
Right.
Which makes it safe. This makes it safe. You can come for healing, confession. I get a lot of confession and absolution. I had a lot of people come to me with their deep, dark secrets, tell me things they were never able to tell anybody else on this planet, and feel accepted, loved, and if they wanted, forgiven.
And how did that make you feel? Did that make you feel honored, or what did that do for you?
I felt like I had a calling, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's like, I prayed every time before I saw a client. If this was a very sacred thing, you know? And if the more you build your intention in that direction, the more you get clients who are bringing you this part of themselves, or bringing you, like, broken parts of themselves to be healed. And there is no better feeling than be able to use acceptance, unconditional love, and orgasms to take somebody from a place of shame and fear to a place where they are expanding and joyful.
Just by being the act of intimacy and touching and pleasure.
Well, you have to be there with the intention of you know, creating this healing encounter for people.
Go ahead.
I listen to a lot of, I do a lot of talking with my clients too. It wasn't just touching, a lot of talking. So it was the whole thing, connecting on every single level.
But did you ever feel at some point you actually transcended who you were and became the embodiment of the Divine Feminine?
Yeah, absolutely.
What was that like? Tell me about that.
Well, it's the vulnerability of my clients just took my breath away. And this is where I really began to value the healing aspects of sex, because you could take somebody out of the banal and help them go into a place that was really vulnerable and sacred. And, you know, I can think of like prostate massage. Prostate massage for somebody, a man who's never been penetrated before and never had an internal orgasm before. And to find out that he's able to do this, and to find out what an earth-shaking, amazing, emotional journey that is. And to have them collapse in your arms, sobbing. I felt really, you know, privileged to be a part of that and to be a witness to that. And it became to me a really, really important thing to create safety for this, so that I could help people go on this journey.
Was there anything you wouldn't do? Anything that you...
Oh, God, tons of things I wouldn't do. Tons of things. If you want to stay in integrity, you need to have exquisite boundaries.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, trying to be a one-stop shopping center for everybody, that's Walmart or McDonald's, if you ask me.
What kind of boundaries would you have, and how would you know they were, you know, safe boundaries as opposed to hang-ups, let's say? How do you know that fine line between boundaries and conditioning?
Well, first of all, if I did have a hang-up, I wouldn't judge myself for it.
Right.
So that would be the very first thing I would do, is I would practice what I preach, which is to give myself unconditional love and acceptance. And if I did have a hang up, I would honor it and tell it wasn't a hang up, and I certainly wouldn't make a big deal out of it needing to go away.
So what was a boundary then for you?
Oh God, I the biggest boundaries for me were really around safer sex techniques.
What kind of sex techniques?
Safer sex.
Safe.
So I was always kept myself safe, used latex barriers. I never took shortcuts with that.
Smart. I think that's, you know, of course it's boundaries, but it's also, you know, you're smart. You're intelligent.
Some girls think you can't work that way, and in fact you will lose a few clients. But
right.
That was, well, I always thought, you know, you're not going to come visit me in the hospital while I'm dying, so.
Right.
No. And there's
exactly.
no money worth my health.
Exactly.
So, it was very, 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 very safe. And you know, that was a big boundary. Another boundary, since I'm an incest survivor, I would never, ever do fantasy role play that had anything to do with somebody underage. Absolutely not. And I didn't have a judgment about that. I would much rather that people who have fantasies like that would take them to professionals and act them out rather than take it out on the public.
Right.
And certainly I wouldn't help. They would not be taking it out on their provider. They would just be acting out a fantasy role play. And it could be perfectly harmless. There's married couples that have those kind of fantasy role plays and get a lot out of it. But for me, knowing that that would be triggering for me and that would be damaging for me, then I would honor and respect that for me without trying to make the client feel guilty for having suggested it.
Right.
It would be like, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You should probably go see somebody else.
Mm. So what's your work about now? What do you really want to take your sexual knowledge and spiritual understanding? Where do you want to go?
Well, I spent this last year developing quite a few workshops, and I actually have, I had a heck of a lot of fun this last summer coaching couples when they're actually having sex. So I led these group sex workshops where people would come take the workshop, and we'd spend the first hour and a half working on deep emotional issues in the relationship. And then they would take their clothes off and engage in sexual activity, and I would coach them through this, usually with the intention of traveling through some of the emotional blocks so that they could get to bigger orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of fun.
Well, you know what I find happens if you're with someone? There's a sort of automaticness that happens. You do this, I do this. And how do you get over that automatic behavior?
You know, you have to make a conscious decision to keep seeing your partner with fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that just is a very simple, easy tool, but one that takes some discipline, is to date your partner. So what that means is you actually have to set aside at least one night a month where you go out and you are not allowed to talk about mundane things like the bills or, you know, who's taking the garbage out or who's picking the kids up and whatever. It has to be we go out on a date as if we're just getting to know each other and we ask each other probing questions about politics, religion, art, current affairs. And you listen to your partner as if you never met him before.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? It's exciting. It's so exciting. I'm working on a book right now called The Straight Man's Guide to Getting Laid.
Uh-huh.
And my ex-husband was just incredibly popular with women all his life. So I interviewed him for the book.
Uh-huh.
And it was so much fun. I have known this man for a quarter of a century, and I learned things about him. It's exciting.
Do you want to give us some of those tips that you're writing?
You have some tips on how to get laid, Alan?
Yeah, can you give me some tips?
Oh, give you some tips.
Give me some
tips.
I
thought you were going to give our listeners some tips.
I'd like to hear what you have to say, what you've learned.
I'm not going to give the whole book away, but I will tell you, one of the things that really surprised me was that men who have genuinely been popular with women, and I'm not talking about guys who know just how to get them in bed and then piss them off, right?
Uh-huh.
But guys who know how to not only have sex with beautiful women or not so beautiful women or whatever, but who've had, you know, quite a few sexual partners, who still like them,
uh-huh.
It seems like the approach is very much about these are people.
Uh-huh.
So instead of approaching them as if, oh, I got to figure women out. Women are different creatures. I don't know what they're about. My dad always told me you'll never be able to figure out your mother or any other woman.
Uh-huh.
Getting beyond that and just going, this is a person, and this person probably likes sex as much as I do.
Uh-huh. I see.
So,
that's good.
Yeah, I thought, you know, as simplistic as that is, I actually thought it was kind of revolutionary because our culture right now is into the whole Mars, Venus, men or women are from different planets thing.
Yeah.
So to suggest that we are actually very, very similar from each other and that the best way to get to know another person is to figure that they're another person.
As opposed to male or female, that is, yeah.
Right. Right, because I think when you approach a man as a man or a woman as a woman, you immediately have built in this polarizing hostility.
Yeah. Do you think there's some difference in the way men and women think? Or, I mean, they're probably more similar than different, but there's a difference.
Well, I like I said, I've worked with men and women's bodies and psyches, and I've definitely noticed some big cultural differences, but I haven't noticed very many organic differences. I say that with one caveat. You know, I was pregnant one time in my life, and I got to tell you, that was the only time in my life that I fully understood a lot of the other women on this planet. Because I have been testosterone-driven most of my life, and being bathed in estrogen was a real mind-bender.
Uh-huh.
I started having all kinds of thoughts and feelings I'd never had before.
Like what?
I started thinking that babies were cute. And
well, they are.
I got,
estrogen.
I never felt that way before.
Uh-huh.
I just really didn't have time for them. I always about my career.
Uh-huh.
Not like I didn't like them, but they just weren't interesting to me. And I couldn't understand why women were interested in, the home. Not very little interest in my home. Never learned how to decorate it or anything like that. All of a sudden, I started having these nesting impulses.
So there is some chemical
effect. I think there is. You know,
that's
it was also just a shift in the energy. I wanted my husband to take care of me and open doors for me, and I'd always been like this woman who's out there doing her own heavy lifting and opening doors, and I miscarried, so I didn't even make it past 3 months. It's not like I was physically incapacitated, but my whole attitude was shifting to one of wanting to be supported and protected. And you know, was that training? Is that the family of origin I came out of? These kind of questions are not the easiest thing to answer. But I do know, I remember the very day that my testosterone kicked in again, because I was driving down the road, feeling one way, and all of a sudden I felt it kick in. And I said, I'm back, baby.
That is.
And I, you know, all of a sudden the career got real important again, and I got very driven.
So what is your career? What do you feel like is, where are you driving to now?
You know, I think all along for me it's really been about wanting to shift the paradigm that we're existing in where women are punished for being sexual, and I think that's been the hugest impetus for me, is that it just causes me a great deal of pain to know that there's young girls that are being called sluts in school right now. It pains me to know that there's girls who think that they deserve to get date raped, that there's something they did wrong. And it pains me to know that there's women right here in this country that are being raped and murdered because they work as prostitutes.
Right.
So those things, you know, are just women who aren't being brutalized, but who have sacrificed their sexual core so that they can live up to being the perfect mom. Who's the perfect mom? The Virgin Mary. That's the perfect mom.
Right.
And that's a really horrible thing to put on women.
It's great. I'm really happy to know that you're such a compassionate person and really care to uplift the culture through new orientation to sex. I think it's very important.
You know, Alan, I really think that the best activism is born out of exquisite selfishness. I think that if each and every one of us found that place where we have our own special pain and struggle. And for me, it was growing up in a home that really looked down on me for being a sexual person. And then a culture that looked down on me for being sexual. So it's not so much that I'm compassionate as that I got angry about being hurt. And
right.
I turned that anger into something positive and an opportunity to help other people. But I'm very much, you know, it's about healing my own wounds. And I really encourage people to find these areas where, you know, you have your own wounding and and take up the cause to change that in the world, and then you will automatically wind up helping other people.
Hmm. So just wrapping up, tell us where you're going to be doing workshops and what your work is now and how people can find you. And
Right now, I don't have actual dates, but I'm going to be scheduling workshops for Miami, New Orleans, and Vancouver, British Columbia. And then I always go up to Seattle in the fall.
Well, you should come to New York. I could help you do some workshops in New York, actually.
I would love to do that. Love to come to New York and teach.
Yeah, we have a one-taste community here. And
yes. Yes, and I've been talking to a few other people out there too, like Sexy Spirits.
Yes, Angela, so, Sexy Spirits. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to do a tour. I haven't been to New York since one of my clients flew me out there for a $16,000 date.
That's a nice date. So
it was great. I went to my first Broadway play. It was so much fun.
Oh, that's good. I'll take you to a Broadway play, too, when you come back.
All right. I'll look forward to that, Alan.
But tell me, when you do these talks, what exactly what's your workshop like? Just give us a little outline of the things you cover.
Well, I have a whole bunch of different workshops. So I already mentioned the ones where couples actually come in, work on their relationship issues, then get naked and have sex.
And you coach them while they're having sex, you say, not like
I
that.
I do. I get down there on my hands and knees and whisper in their ears and all kinds of stuff. It's awesome.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. It's a total gas. And I've had the privilege of helping some people get past some sexual barriers. You know, people maybe haven't been able to ejaculation for 6 months, and all of a sudden they could. Or just stuff like that that's very exciting.
Yeah, is that it? Sometimes women say it feels like they're urinating, right? Is that possible?
Yes, but here's the female anatomy is set up thus. There are spongy tissues, very much like the spongy tissue that it creates the erection for a male penis.
Uh-huh.
That spongy tissue lies just underneath the surface of the vagina and forms a portion of the G-spot.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got these two little ducts that lie on either side of the urethra. Now, the urethra is where the urine comes out of,
uh-huh.
but the two ducts to the side are where the ejaculate comes out of.
Or the vaginal secretions come out of there, huh?
No, the vaginal secretions are the Bartholin's glands, which are at the entrance of the vagina.
Oh, so those little ducts are specifically for feminine ejaculate.
They are, and they kind of, it looks like you got one big hole and then two little tiny pinholes on either side of it.
Oh, I see.
And this has been photographed, and what happens is these two streams of ejaculate come out, and then they immediately join because they're so close to each other, and it looks like there's one stream of ejaculate coming out.
Now, how do you get that ejaculate to ejaculate?
Well, a really common way to do this, and not every woman enjoys this or responds to it, but a very common way to do this is by stimulating the G-spot. And you put your finger about an inch and a half to 2 inches inside a woman's vagina, and you make the come hither motion with your finger while she's laying on her back. So you would be like pointing your finger towards her stomach.
Right, and moving it
that
forward.
That G-spot starts to actually, the tissue, the spongy tissue actually starts to become erect, and it creates a little, it kind of feels like the roof of your mouth.
Right, that's
and the
spongy,
the more you play with it, then this can lead to ejaculation. Some women find that pleasurable, and some women do not. Other women ejaculate just through stimulation of the clitoris. So there's a lot of ways to get there.
Because in these old Japanese erotic paintings, they have these men walking around with these buckets to collect the ejaculate of women and for healing purposes.
The women in ancient Egypt used to use their ejaculate on their face to give themselves a nice complexion.
And that's actually
women in Africa who used to have competitions ejaculating against a wall to see who could do it the farthest.
Well, it's supposedly very healing for the men because that's pure yin essence, as in the man will take that in through the tip of the penis, the gland of the penis will absorb that yin fluid in order to re-nourish the male energy, actually.
It's also amazing lubricant, too. And here's the thing about ejaculate that I really want your listeners to know, too. It's not urine. Sometimes a little bit of urine will come out of the bladder at the same time, so you'll get a little urine in there. But if you empty your bladder and then try to stimulate the G-spot and you have a female ejaculation, you're going to notice that it has kind of an oily texture to it, which is not at all like urine. And it can range in odor from being kind of mildly nutty like almonds to really deeply musky like a forest.
How long, would you have to stimulate the G-spot for that to happen?
Oh, it varies from everybody. There's a wonderful DVD out there, if you can get it from Femme Fatale. It's called How to Female Ejaculate. I was actually sitting on the set the day they produced this film, so I got to see the live action. But there is a woman on there called Dr. Shannon Bell, and I consider her the Olympic ejaculator. All she has to do is, like, just stick her finger up inside, stimulate her G-spot for about 3 seconds, and she just comes all over the place, and she can do it repeatedly.
Wow.
So,
there's another movie out called The Fountains of Life or something.
Yeah. I haven't got to see. That's a new one. I haven't gotten to see that yet.
That's really good. I saw that. But that's
you don't
give courses in female ejaculation, do you?
Well, I don't yet, but, you know, I might start.
You ejaculate.
I've always...
Is that something you do personally?
Oh, yeah. I've done that in every single adult film I've ever been in.
You ejaculate the...
I never get in front of a camera without ejaculating.
What films were you in? What was your biggest film?
I did one recently in 2005. I did one for Libido Films. And it's got a very simple title. It's just called O.
O.
Oh. Yeah, O-H-O.
Okay.
And last time I checked, you could actually buy that on Amazon.com.
All right. But getting back to your workshops and your talks, what other subjects do you talk about? You talk about the shame. You talk about couples coaching.
I do. I've got Shelter from Sexual Shame, and then I've got the one that's based on the book, Sex Secrets of Escorts.
That's the book you wrote.
That's the book I wrote. Yes, okay. Sex Secrets of Escorts, Tips from a Pro. So I have a workshop that's based around the book.
One of those secrets?
Well, there's a sexual position called the Isis Squat, which you're going to have to buy the book if you want, or come to one of my workshops if you want to learn it. But I will tell you one thing about the Isis Squat. You cannot find it in most human porn. But I did see it on a nature show, and it was... a couple of bonobos were doing it.
How did you discover that?
Cozy Fabian taught it in her workshop. It's named after the goddess Isis.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And it's kind of being passed down from prostitute to prostitute.
And what's the purpose of that position?
This position is very erotic for the man and gives the woman an exquisite level of control so that she can obtain her own power, and she can also be very much in charge of the sex act.
I see.
Yeah.
We'll have to do a video
interview.
It's very, very awesome. Let's do a video interview when you come to New York.
I would love to do that.
Okay.
Upcoming lectures, I'm doing like Sorting the Sex from the Violence, Building a Bridge from Sexual Shame to Peace, and the ways in which we are destroying planet Earth through our sexual taboos. Those are some of the stuff that I'm working on new. But I find that Probably the most popular workshop that I introduced this last year was Embracing Male Lust.
Embracing Male Lust?
Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I had great success with it in both Seattle and San Francisco. And what I found was that this was for the population of men who are really being very conscientious in their relationship with women,
mm-hmm.
and they're having difficulty connecting with their sexuality as men because they're so afraid of being abusive or the perpetrator or objectifying the woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the backlash to, you know, it's like we've become so politically correct that men are, they're apologizing for getting erections.
So then what do you tell these men?
Well, we exploit, you know, I don't just tell them. It's kind of an encounter group where I encourage a lot of discourse, but I moderate it. And I come in as a bisexual woman who has been date raped and incested and abused, and I totally understand that aspect, and I definitely identify as a feminist. And I also relate to them as a bisexual woman who's tried to come on to women and get women to go out with me, and I've been turned down, and I've also, you know, been very successful.
Uh-huh.
So having a lot of experience is really helpful, and being able to build that bridge between the two genders and being a bisexual makes me.
And you also relate to them probably as a sexual woman who knows what you like as a woman as far as men are concerned.
Yes, yeah, and so this becomes like a really rich environment for them to kind of tap into all of this different information and be able to discuss it without fear of alienating me, because I talk, you know, with men where they live. I don't try to get them to adopt what I would consider a female-centric language in order to be accepted. So that just creates a great deal of comfort, and we can, you know, tell off-color jokes if we want to, or say things that are not politically correct, and we can also discuss, you know, the fact that most of the people who come to these workshops are not just interested in scoring, per se, to use a euphemism. They're very much interested in connecting, and they want to be good guys, but they also want to be sexy, take-charge guys. I'm just trying to find where do you find the ability to navigate those waters, you know?
Uh-huh. Do you like David Data's work? Are you interested in that?
Yeah, I am. I can't profess that I have a real working knowledge of it to where I would be able to speak intelligently about it, but yes, I'm interested
It sort of fits in with what you're saying, giving men back their power, having men have their power with women, as opposed to what he says, the second stage, always trying to, you know, make sure that, you know, to be that politically correct behavior is like coming back into our power in relationship to women, but not power over, you know, that's where...
Right, because, you know, confidence and power are incredibly sexy,
mm-hmm.
and for both genders, and I would encourage both men and women to get in touch with their power and not be afraid to express it.
I think we should do that workshop in New York. That sounds like a good one.
Right.
But
I want to.
just to finish up, the thing that you said interesting before was this connection between the disregard for the earth and sexuality. Now, how do you connect that?
Again, so much of life, everything about life, you know, life itself comes from sex. So, okay, since I have been born, the planet is, I don't know, I think it's doubled in size as far as the population goes.
Yeah.
Which is frightening. It's frightening, and it's increasing exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
So we have too many people on this planet.
Well,
and there's a couple of things going on there. One thing that we've got going on is religious dictums that say, go forth and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've got the Catholic Church basically saying that you can't use birth control. And then we've got the whole whore Madonna shame thing going on where women are afraid to be carrying condoms because it'll make them look like some kind of a slut.
Right.
We have countries that still arrest prostitutes. They'll arrest any woman who's carrying more than two condoms on suspicion of being a prostitute. So we're contributing to the population explosion through this sexual bias and sexual shame, and then also spreading AIDS. And then we can't talk intelligently about non-procreative forms of sex. So since we've decided the sex is just about penises and vaginas, then, you know, we can't talk about oral sex, and we can't talk about mutual masturbation, and we can't even talk about tantric principles where you could be having mind-blowing fire-breath orgasms without ever being in the same room with another person or taking your clothes off.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jocelyn Elders, it wasn't that long ago that she was fired for mentioning masturbation as a good thing to teach our kids so that they wouldn't be having teen pregnancies and catching AIDS.
Right.
So those are
I don't think actually we have too many people. I mean, I know the Earth is crowded, but I think we have the technology to support the population. It's just there's a lot of greed going on. That's why, you know, people are starving and we don't have an equal distribution of resources. I don't think, you know, it's
necessarily overpopulated. Well, I hear you, but no, I would challenge that because I it's my understanding that if every person on this planet was to actually eat a healthy diet, you know, with plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, we don't have enough land to actually grow all those fruits and vegetables. So
I think we do. If you just ever fly over the country and see those huge spaces.
Just let me finish. Let me finish, Alan.
Okay, go ahead.
We are absolutely married to farming, you know, industrial farming, which can only be accomplished by depleting the soil, which means you have to put in artificial fertilizers and you have to use pesticides. So now we are locked into, again, destroying our environment. And right now what's going on in a lot of third world countries is they are just chopping down the rainforest faster than we can keep track of. So we're losing the Congo and the Amazon, which are like the two lungs of the earth, because people are trying to make a living and they're trying to feed themselves. And so that contributes to global warming.
No, I totally see that because we've been ignorant and greedy and have poor farming practices, but I think we have a technology for a whole new society and like your work, a whole new way of relating to each other and our bodies. We need to
When I heard there wasn't enough land to grow fresh fruits and vegetables for everybody, one of the first things that came to my mind was, what about the tops of all the high-rises?
Exactly.
So I'm thinking maybe if everybody was growing their own little organic gardens upstairs, that would not be a limiting factor. But the way it is right now, we've got, you know, people living off of genetically modified corn and soy, and I don't know if you buy into that or not, but it's a huge
thing
for me.
I think it's awful to genetically modify. There's no chi in those genetically modified plants.
There isn't. If you take a piece of organic food, it is alive. It is bursting with energy. And you take something that's even not genetically modified, just conventionally raised with all the pesticides, it's like a dead hunk of flesh.
No, I know. And you don't get any energy from it. It's like eating cardboard. It's awful.
So if we had respect for sexuality, I also think that we would have more respect for the mechanism by which life is created, and we wouldn't be treating it like it's just another machine we got to figure out how to control and run. But, you know, we're taking this same approach to our sex lives because, you know, it's like Viagra is hugely popular now, even with young men in their 20s.
Viagra is popular with young men in their 20s?
Yes, because, you know, if more is always better.
Mm.
So if you can take a Viagra and make yourself even harder and make yourself last even longer. I mean, that's the kind of competitive attitude that we have towards sex. We're not approaching it from an organic, you know, spiritual place. We're coming at it from always, like, kind of like extreme sports. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the records that they set years and years ago. Everybody's just out trying to beat that record. And I live way up in the woods, and I love the peace and quiet up here. But it's always interesting to see the weekend warriors come up here because all they want to do is conquer the woods.
Right.
You know? They want to bring their snowmobiles and their motorcycles and just rip it up and make a bunch of noise and then go home and say they spent time in the forest.
Right.
Well, I'm like, okay.
How can people find you or get a hold of you or hear more about you?
It is real easy to get a hold of me. I'm going to give you some numbers and emails and websites. But if you ever have trouble finding me, you just go to your favorite search engine and put in the name Monet, like Claude Monet the painter, M-O-N-E-T, Monet, and the word sex.
Okay.
Monet is my last name. Sex is my business, and it will bring up about 20 pages. Most of it's true. Some of it isn't.
Okay. That's okay.
So, but here's my two websites. You can find out more about me at veronicamonet.com, veronicamonet.com. And you can find out more about what I can do for you at sexwithoutshame.com. Sexwithoutshame.com. And then you can call my 800 number, which is 888-903-0050. That's 888-903-0050. And you can also email me at veronica@veronicamonet.com, or you can send it to veronica@sexwithoutshame.com.
Well, thank you, Veronica. Let's have some more talks about sex without shame. And
I look forward to it. This was really a lot of fun.
Nice to hear your story and your insights and your wisdom from, you know, just being out there and being out there so openly and generously in a way, you know? It's a great gift that you've given a lot of people. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
You know, it makes it all worth it. It really does. Like I said, you know, a lot of this is about my own personal journey, and I love sharing it with the public. But, you know, it's for every person out there, a detractor who says something negative and hurtful, there's so many more people who are just been incredibly supportive, and I'm very grateful to each and every one of you that sends those nice emails, and it helps me keep the fire and keep going.
Well, I look forward to seeing you again.
All right, Alan. Yeah, what's the weather like out there in New York?
It's about 40 degrees. It's cool. Getting warmer, but it's still a little bit of a winter in the air.
I'll
let people know about this, about your work and your workshops as you decide to come to New York.
I look forward to it. Maybe sometime this year.
What's that?
We'll have to see.
Oh, definitely sometime. So, but we'll be in touch anyway. So, thank you for being a guest on New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and if you want to reach me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. You can check my website, newrealities.com or newrealitiestv.tv. And I'm here every Tuesday on DBS Radio, and I welcome feedback. So, Thank you for listening, and I'll hope to hear from you and see some people next time. Thank you.